Good evening, listeners. Welcome to Damn Radio. If you'd like to call in, please do. Call 573-746-8020 or email live at damradio.com. This is Jack's Car Show. I'm broadcasting live from the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. This is Damn Radio. I apologize. I guess I'm getting over a cold or something. My voice is a little bit gravelly. But main focus of the show tonight is going to be Saab. I suspect Saab guys won't be that into it, honestly. Specifically, I want to focus on the later years and what happened to them and why they went away. But first, I want to get into some miscellaneous stuff. So recently, I was on eBay a couple weeks ago, and I stumbled across a listing for an old 1980s Cincinnati microwave escort radar detector, the original escort. And it was in great shape, and you know, it apparently worked, and the guy wanted like $20 for it. And so I thought, you know, why not? I wouldn't want that for $20. You know, that's cool. $20 doesn't get you anything now, so it's like, you know, this thing's just kind of a cool little knickknack just to have on my desk because it's a neat little thing. And I'll preface this by saying I'm kind of a big fan of radar detectors. I like them. I'm not an expert on them or anything, but I tend to speed. And, like, I'm enthusiastic about radar detectors to the point that I don't want to be one of those guys who posts on Facebook, like, I just bought this radar detector and I think it's broken because I drove past a cop and it didn't go off. Or, you know, just people who refer to the detector, the radar detector, as a radar. Like, I just installed a radar in my car. You know, those guys. Like, I know more about detectors than those guys, but I wouldn't say I'm a hardcore enthusiast. But I think overall they're useless unless you have some idea of how they work. And usually when you talk about radar detectors, you get some retard in there like, why would you spend all that money on trying to avoid tickets? Why don't you just drive the speed limit? And those are exactly the same people who are like, why do you care about privacy if you're not doing anything wrong? They're bootlickers. You know, those are the people whose only measure of safe driving is obeying the law, not actually having any situational awareness or ability to control an automobile. Like, the only thing that matters to these people is the willingness to blindly follow statutes. And there's other segments of people against radar detectors, and not just the bootlickers as such, but it seems like a pretty large segment of the population these days talks about how radar detectors are useless now because of all the stuff that causes false alerts. There's automatic doors and blind spot monitoring and whatnot. And that's fair. Although, I suspect a lot of that stems from these guys probably had something like a Passport 8500 15 years ago, and then they tried to use it recently, and it was just constantly falsing, as if there's not a better, newer radar detector available. You know, if you spend any kind of halfway decent money now, you can cut out 95% of that. But that's the exact reason you don't want old radar detectors, and It's why, like, listen, I think 70s and 80s radar detectors are cool, just at least as decoration for an older car, you know, or just a collector's item to sit on a shelf like I kind of want. So, you know, in my mind, I think they'd be worth at least something, but no, I mean, they're practically free because you can't use them as radar detectors. Detection range and false alert filtering determines the value completely, regardless of how age or how cool it is. You know, that's why I pay $20 for this thing. That's just what they cost, because you can't use it as a radar detector. And so I thought it'd be fun to just try exactly that. Just use it as a radar detector. Just plug it in and see what it does. And so I had extremely low expectations for this old Escort. I assumed I'd drive around with it, and it would just be going off nonstop. Like, I figured it would be constantly making noise, never quiet ever. But honestly, it wasn't. That's what's surprising about it. It was, like, decently quiet. And I have some theories as to why. You see, when it comes to police radar, there's basically three frequency ranges that they operate at. The first one that became popular when police radar guns became popular in, like, the 60s was X-band. And then in the 70s, K-band came along, and that became the hot new police radar frequency. And so that was what it was by the end of the 70s. And so when the original Escort came out in 79, like mine, that was all it needed to detect was X and K. And at the time, nothing else really used radar outside of police radar guns and, like, aircraft carriers. So you wouldn't really get a whole lot of false alerts with these things. So they were very effective, but those were all it could detect was X and K. Well, in the late 80s, KA band came about, and it became popular among law enforcement. And that's really still the standard. That's what probably 90% of police officers use these days is KA. And if your radar detector goes off and it's a KA hit, it's a cop. I mean, 10 times out of 10, they're the only ones that use KA. But over time, X and then later K, they started being used for other things. So your detector goes off for K these days, you pretty much ignore it. Unless you're in some smaller jurisdiction, like Lake Ozark Police Department still uses K. as does Sunrise Beach in some cases. X isn't really a thing anymore anywhere. X is really only used by police in New Jersey, and then even then only barely. And so most detectors now just come with X band turned completely off by default. But my point with this is, the only thing that this old Escort could possibly detect are signal bands that are, well, one is usually disabled from the factory on newer stuff, and and the other is like, you know, you pick up a signal, you pretty safely ignore it, K. And, you know, both of these bands are your stuff that are used for speed signs and grocery store front doors or automotive blind spot monitoring and parking sensors, any number of things that should cause this thing to go crazy. But despite all that, honestly, it was pretty quiet. Like, it was not that bad to use. And I'm guessing it's, my theory is the frequency ranges that this other stuff operates at wouldn't have commonly been used when this thing was new yet. Like, all that stuff I just named operates on old, out-of-date frequencies by police radar standards, by radar detector standards, but I suspect a lot of it is actually too new to even register on this thing. Like, there's a false K-band signal by the Hy-Vee in Osage Beach, and it always shows up on my Uniden. This Escort has not picked it up once. So my theory is, it's not that this thing is good at filtering out false alerts. It's dreadful at that. It's just that all the false alerts are too advanced for this thing. We've come full circle. Like, this thing's actually quiet because it can't pick up anything. And I think that's great. But the thing that actually surprised me about this thing is it actually picked up a cop. I was driving in Sunrise Beach, and up to that point, every signal it got, the thing, it just beeped once, and then that was it. It went quiet again. But when there was a cop, the signal actually ramped up like, you know, it would. Like, it, you know, it starts beeping repeatedly and quickly, like when there's an actual strong signal, like they do. And so there you go. It was technically, it picked up a cop. I mean, to be clear, I saw the cop first, but the detector did catch it. So that's Mike Valentine era Escort for you. That was peak radar detector, really. It's still picking up cops even to this day. And another thing, this thing is actually better than a newer Escort in one respect. Because I don't like using new Escorts for a few reasons, but the big one in my mind is you can't easily distinguish between a K or a KA signal just by the sound. The alerts sound the same, at least to me. Like on my Uniden, you can know just by listening. You don't have to look at the screen. You just know by listening if it's a priority or not. Because most of the time, you can ignore a K signal, and you know because it's a kind of noise, you know? But you'll know to slow down immediately if it's a KA signal, and you'll know it's a KA signal because it's like a wee, 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 wee kind of noise. But on a new Escort, it's like it's all kind of the same noise, at least to my ears. And that really bothers me. Like, I need to know if I care or not. And you know, if I do need to care, looking at the screen is going to slow me down. You know, it's like, am I going to take it then? So I don't like that. But the thing is, this old one, like the X hits are these little twinkly bell beep noises, and the Ks are more aggressive, kind of noise. Typical radar detector noises. So this thing's great. Like, I like it, honestly. I wouldn't use it as a detector, but it's kind of a cool little thing. I'm glad I bought it. But anyway, moving on. In the last show, I talked about Slate, which is... it's a truck brand, and it's backed by Jeff Bezos, and they're trying to sell $30,000 electric trucks that don't have a stereo. And I said that when push comes to shove, nobody's actually going to want such a simple vehicle. And I suspect I'm right, but they have over 100,000 reservations at this point, so that's interesting. To be clear, I am right. Nobody's going to get the base model like I predicted, and that's assuming anybody's going to buy this thing at all, because 100,000 reservations sounds like a lot. You know, you have to assume quite a few of them are fleet sales that are, you know, fleets that are going to end up with several of these things. And so that's probably a decent chunk right there. But the main thing that's driven this enthusiasm is reserving a Slate costs a fully refundable $50. So I would bet money that probably half of these people are, well, I mean, they fall into a couple categories. A, they're people trying to get a good place in line so they can scalp an early allocation later to somebody who actually will buy this truck. Or B, they're reserving one just in case they decide they want one, because it's $50 refundable. Who cares? I suspect most of these reservations are C. And C, people who wanted to reserve one so they could have a reservation, so that they could screenshot it and send it to their friends saying, look, I just reserved a Slate, I can't wait. And then there's going to be some stupid minor delay or something, and then the person will inevitably, quote-unquote, change their mind, and then they'll get their $50 back. I wonder how many reservations they'd have if it was 500 to reserve one. In fact, I wonder how many they'd have if it was simply a non-refundable $50. It's probably less than half as many as they do now. You know, Tesla at one point had a million reservations for the Cybertruck, and they've sold like 50,000 total since it went on sale, I guess a year and a half ago at this point. And now they can't give those things away. I mean, nobody's buying them. So that kind of shows where I think this is going. I'm interested to see how this ends up. But I'm going to move into motorcycles for a second. A couple of shows back, I talked about how I like the idea of electric motorcycles and how cool they could be. And the only company that's actually doing electric motorcycles properly is somehow Harley-Davidson, because they make the Livewire line of bikes. And I think the Livewires are really awesome. Some of the marketing's questionable, which I'll get to, but honestly, I think they're really sick. The main reason I bring this up is the market apparently disagrees with me savagely, because Harley said, when they announced the Livewire brand a couple of years ago, they were hoping to sell 100,000 bikes a year by 2026, which, I mean, okay, in a given year, Harley-Davidson itself maybe sells 150,000. And so they somehow thought that Livewire could move 100,000 electric bikes. Good luck with that 100,000 units. It turns out, though, in the first quarter of this year, they managed to sell 33 motorcycles. The entire Livewire brand in the first 3 months of 2025 managed to move 33 units. That's 11 motorcycles per month, 132 a year. And the CEO, the outgoing CEO, for obvious reasons, the German guy, he partially blamed a lack of EV charging infrastructure, which 10 years ago, okay, yeah, the lack of whatever. But in 2025, that doesn't hold up that well. The Tesla Model Y is usually one of the best-selling cars in the world. Let's not pretend like lack of charging infrastructure is a problem with the infrastructure itself in this day and age. If the charging infrastructure is a problem with the Livewire, obviously the bigger problem is the range of the bikes. What I mean is, the top trim bike they sell, the Livewire 1, and that was the one that it was debuted as the Harley-Davidson Livewire a couple of years ago before they split Livewire off as being its own thing. They're still asking $23,000 for this thing, by the way, which is laughable. But what I think is funny is that on Livewire's website, they describe it as a, quote, electric sports tourer. Two of those words are pretty much correct. Electric. Yeah, sure. I mean, you can't really argue that. Sports. Yep, 0 to 60 in 3 seconds. Very good. I mean, you know, 600s will do that for $12,000, but fine. And it's heavy, you know, so handling, whatever. But it's fine. Sports, if you want it, fine, take it. The word I have an issue with is tourer. Look at the Livewire 1 and tell me it looks like a comfortable touring motorcycle. It's like, man, it looks like a Goldwing, doesn't it? There's no wind protection, for one. And the seat, I mean, the seat looks like it'd be as comfortable as... It's probably the same amount of cushion as like sitting on a stack of paper. The main thing in my mind is they claim 146 miles on a charge. In fact, they say that's city riding, which for these sorts of things, you know, EVs, usually city riding is best case. You know, 45 mile an hour city riding is a lot more efficient than 80 mile an hour interstate riding. But what kind of touring are they hoping for on an electric bike with a best case theoretical range of 146 miles, which in real life is probably more like 80 or 90 by the time you get on a highway? So, yeah, I guess when you have to stop that often, maybe there are too few charging stations. I don't know. But in any case, pathetic range. So the way they're pitching that bike is stupid as a tourer, especially when, again, it's $23,000. Like a nicely optioned BMW GS is about that. An actual Goldwing. What's a Goldwing now? It's probably 25. That's the best touring bike in the world. It's similar money. But I guess they have to pretend like it was made for touring to explain why this thing is so much more expensive than the other ones they sell. And speaking of the other ones they sell, the cheapest one is the S2 Alpinista. And even that's $16,000. Also 0 to 60 in 3 seconds, but I mean only 120 miles of city range, which, again, you say maybe 2/3 of that in any real situation. And look, I think it's a cool bike. I don't know why you'd ever buy it. $16,000. For that money, just spend another grand and get a CBR1000. Or an even better, more comparable bike, just the naked version. Get the CB1000. That's like 12-something. And by the way, that the base model isn't even the one you want. That one's the ugliest. The best one is more or less the same bike. It's just it's more flat tracker kind of looking. It's the S2 Del Mar, and it's awesome. But it's another $250. And I like it. I don't $16,000 like it. And look, I get it. Harley has always been in the business of overcharging for things just because they can. Clearly, this hasn't worked like they've wanted. That being said, I will totally buy a Livewire S2 when they get cheap, which they will, because they just will. You know, $16,000 is too much money for this thing. I suspect there'll be 5 here in about 3 years. If for no other reason, then that's just what happens with this sort of stuff. Like, I can remember okay, the Nissan Leaf came out in 2011, and it cost in the 30s, but I can remember a couple years after that. I remember back in 2017, 2018, again, Leafs were still fairly new cars, and every single used Leaf cost like $5,000. Nobody wanted them because people just assumed they were garbage and the batteries would fail and the car would just be a brick. And also, I mean, LiveWire as a brand can't possibly be around much longer, so how much support will there be for this thing? That'll kill the value probably more than anything. And I mean, again, they keep with the current trajectory. They're only going to sell 132 bikes this year, so the brand will go away and the dealers will just be giving these things away. In fact, there you go. You might even get one new for $5,000 once the dealer is just desperate to dump old stock and be done with it. But wait, one more thing before I get into Saab. I haven't talked about used luxury car bargains on here lately, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but this just occurred to me the other day. In fact, the very fact that this car existed just occurred to me the other day. The 2007 to 2015 Jaguar XK, you know, that sports coupe grand touring Jaguar, and you know, 97 Jag comes out with the XK8, and it more or less saved the brand or gave it a massive image boost. And they made that car until 2006, and everybody remembers that one, and you see them pretty regularly. Well, Jaguar came out with a new XK in 2006 for the 2007 model year, and everybody fawned over it and thought it was gorgeous, and it drove great, and it was an Aston Martin for Jaguar money, and it was a great car. And then in 2015, they replaced it with the F-Type, and everybody loved the F-Type and just immediately forgot about that, you know, middle-range XK. I mean, I can remember seeing them a few years ago and thinking they were cheap for what they offered. Now they're really cheap. Like, $10,000 gets you one. If you got $10,000, you get a fairly modern car, fairly modern luxury car, sporty car, with 300 horsepower. It's a V8. They're decently reliable. I mean, again, those engines, the AJ V8s were pretty bulletproof. The car's gorgeous. The interior is really nice. It's very comfortable. It's quick. It's quiet. And those cars are $10,000 or less. I mean, most you see are in the nines. Like, you give them some miles, you can get cheaper than that if you want. And the newer model years are more. They just, you know, they facelifted it and whatever. But the early cars are practically free. I don't understand it. You can get it as a coupe or convertible. The coupe looks better, but convertibles are cool too, whatever. They're pretty much the same price. But they're so cheap. And I suspect it's because everybody forgot those cars existed. I certainly did. But that's a true bargain right there. But anyway, let's move on to Saab. I'm going to take a break here in a second. But anytime anybody talks about Saab, they always make GM the villain in the story. Because, honestly, listen. Okay, GM is the good Samaritan passerby, and Saab is the homeless drug addict. And the passerby gave the homeless guy money, and then the homeless guy blew it all on crack and gas station slot machines. And then the passerby gave the homeless guy another chance and gave him more money, and the same thing happened. That was the GM Saab dynamic until it became completely unsustainable. You know, anytime anybody tells a Saab story, GM is always the bad guy. Like, oh, GM ruined Saab. Saab was a great brand before GM came along and destroyed it. Listen, Saab was pretty constantly on track to destroy itself because they just refused to compromise on any of their values, and it was unsustainable. But that's skipping ahead. I'll start at the beginning of the history of Saab after the break. You're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio. Why did that go away? Really? Oh, okay, here we go. It's a different icon than I'm used to, sorry. All right, you're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio.
I feel the moon rise.
746-8020. So, the beginning of the history of Saab. So, Saab was founded in 1937, and they made fighter jets and stuff like that. And Sweden was neutral in World War II, but they wanted everybody to know how neutral they were by having fighter planes. You know, but the war ended, and obviously the demand for fighter jets saw a pretty steep decline. And so they started focusing their attention on other stuff, like cars. And so in 1945, Saab Automobile was founded as a subsidiary of, you know, regular Saab. And to be clear, to this day, regular Saab still exists, just not the car portion. It's just the military defense side. Saab is still around. So it's like if Toyota went away, but the side that makes forklifts is still around. It's kind of the same thing. It's where Saab is now. People used to make fun of Saab for making these ads. I'll play you one. And by the way, your left ear is really going to enjoy this one. I'm sorry about that. I can't really do anything. I realized at the last minute that it's only one side, but whatever.
Only one aircraft manufacturer makes cars. Sierra, Alpha, Alpha, Bravo, Saab.
You know, the
Saab, what the hell is that?
It's Swedish. It's sporty. It's got a key in the middle to the armrest. It's like a spaceship.
I pulled that from a Saab enthusiast YouTube channel. I forgot to trim that part of it. I think it's great, that outro. I wasn't going to try and play it, but I just forgot to do it. Anyway, if I had more time, it occurred to me at the last minute that I had that and I hadn't had it prepared, but whatever. Anyway, Saab really tried to play into their whole airplane company image because, I mean, just look at a Saab 9000. You can tell that it just exudes the fighter jet spirit. It's really a warplane underneath, but seriously, Saab wasn't a car maker, which perhaps is why they never made any money at building cars, you know. But they weren't a car maker. They were an airplane company that started making cars. And you could see it early on. Because all their cars were extremely flowy and aerodynamic. You know, all the early Saabs, like the 92. If you look at the 92 from the side, it just looks like the cross-section of an airplane wing. And in the first full year on sale, it was 1950, all 92s were painted green. Because that was all Saab had left over in stock. That was left over from building planes. Like, they were a plane company. And for decades, all Saabs used little two-stroke, two-cylinder engines. And when I say for decades, I mean for decades. Because when you think about Saab, you maybe think of three or four cars. Because there really weren't that many to start out with. Because the first car Saab ever made was the 92. And they made that from 49 to 57. And it was replaced by the 93. And then in 1960, they replaced that with the 96, and there was also the 95, which is the wagon version. And they were all pretty much the exact same car. They just kind of kept them updated. And so keep that in mind. They made that 96 up until 1980, by the way. So Saab sold what was essentially an updated 1949 car up until 1980. You know, and those were the original sort of teardrop-shaped Saabs. But in the middle of that run, 67, for the 68 model year, Saab came out with a new car, the 99. And that spawned the 90, and then they came out with a slightly longer 900. And the 900 lasted in its original form until, 1994. You know, those Saabs are that boxy Saab design, like the one Paul Giamatti drove in Sideways, you know. But my point here is, from 1949 to 1994, Saab really only had two basic cars. And there was the Sonet, which is a little sports car, and they sold practically none of them. And I know I'm not counting the 9000, but I'd argue that wasn't really a bespoke Saab. It was partly a Lancia. And, you know, after GM bought them, they started to branch off and come out with a bunch of different models. But even some of those were just regular rebadged GM crap. But that's skipping ahead. My point is, at their core, Saab didn't make that many different cars. They just kind of kept refining the old ones they had. And by the way, 1967, Sweden, same time and place the 99 came out. This isn't really related to this. I just think it's interesting. I've been wanting to talk about this for quite a while, but I never really had a reason to. I'm going to talk about H-Day for a second. Because basically, Sweden had decided that they wanted to switch from driving on the left-hand side of the road to the right. And this is because, for whatever reason, the vast majority of cars sold in Sweden had steering wheels on the left. So, think about that for a second. You know, you're driving a left-hand drive car on a two-lane road in a country where you drive on the left. Like, if you're on a two-lane road, you try to pass somebody, and you're trying to see if there's a car oncoming, you can't see shit. I don't know why they switched the side of the road they drove on instead of just getting right-hand drive cars, because technically right-hand drive makes more sense, but whatever. You know, when they were setting up the whole system of driving on the left versus right, every road was two lanes, and so this stuff kind of mattered more. But, I mean, if you're in the United States or most other countries, you're driving on the right-hand side of the road. You know, you're... to me, right-hand drive makes more sense. You know, because if you're in the United States, you're driving on the right-hand side of the road, you're looking to see if you can pass on a two-lane road, where are you looking? You're looking to your left. Well, 70% of people are right-eye dominant. So why are we doing it that way? I don't know, but whatever. Basically, that's basically the only way that driving on one side or the other actually matters. So it's like, why don't we do it that way? I don't get it, but whatever. Sweden decided they wanted to drive on the right-hand side of the road. That's the point of this, just like the rest of the real world. And you can't just make that change immediately. And so in the months leading up to making this change, Sweden installed signs and traffic signals facing the other direction, but they kept them covered up under black plastic tarps until they made the switch. And they also painted white road markings, you know, lane lines and arrows and whatnot. And prior to the change, all the road markings were yellow. After the change, they're white, you know. So the ones you pay attention to now are the white ones, is the idea. And there's other stuff, like bus stops had to be moved to the other side of the road, as well as a lot of buses themselves had to be converted to put the doors on the other side. Just a whole lot of little changes. But they officially made this transition on the morning of September 3rd, 1967. Basically, between the hours of 1 and 6 a.m., all non-essential traffic was banned from the roads, and workers went around removing tarps and reconfiguring road signs and intersections, and something like 10,000 police officers oversaw this whole operation. And if you were an essential worker and you were actually out driving around, at exactly 4:50 a.m., radio announcements were made, and there were sounds played over storm sirens that said, now is the time to change over. And so at 4:50 a.m., you had to pull over to the side of the road. You had to come to a complete stop and then slowly, cautiously make your way to the other side of the road. And the Swedish government allowed 10 minutes for all the people in the country on the road at the time to make that change. And then at 5 o'clock, you were allowed to just drive off, now driving on the opposite side of the road. And they say that for months after that, people were constantly just driving on the wrong side of the road out of habit, but accidents did decrease, so there's that. But anyway, that's Sweden's H-Day, and it's completely unrelated, but I like it. But I'm moving back to Saab. Saab's main claim to fame when it came to building a brand was safety. Because Saab just became obsessed with safety, which I guess is just a Swedish thing, because that's also what Volvo was known for. But with the Saab, on the 99 and then later the 900, you know, for example, you look at the A-pillar, and in case you don't know, the A-pillar is the front pillar. It's like the windshield, you know, what holds the windshield. Those pillars contain essentially a one-inch steel tube that runs in a straight line from the top of the windshield down back below, you know, behind the fender to basically the corner of the wheel well. And Saab said it was to protect against hitting elk. And hitting elk in Sweden was kind of a problem. You know, you hit a deer, hitting a deer sucks, but unless you're in a little sports car, the very front of the car is going to take the brunt of the damage. But an elk is not that way. An elk is very tall, and it's got long, thin legs and a big body, and so it's really top heavy. You hit one of those, like it just goes straight through the windshield. You're going to have a bad time. And so they wanted their cars to be able to withstand an elk hit. And everybody remembers that Top Gear segment they did about Saab where they dropped it from 8 feet in the air directly on its roof, and the roof didn't really collapse all that much. Like, if you were in it, you could have survived. That was actually a real test that Saab did themselves while designing the 99. Like, that exact accident has probably never occurred in the real world. You just fall directly straight onto your roof. But they wanted this thing to be sturdy, so they did that test. So, good for them, I guess. And also the windshield. I've looked at the 99 and 900 for years, and I've always thought they looked weird. And I think the main reason that's the case, the big one, is it's a somewhat kind of sort of normal looking car, but the windshield is really steep and it's curved really severely. Like the middle of the windshield is way farther forward than the sides. Well, guess why they did that? Airplane canopy. They made airplanes. They wanted everybody to know it. And so, you know, you get a big curved piece of glass around you. You also get good visibility. So that was the rationale. Safety in airplanes. That was Saab for you. But I mean, you know, you look at the 900, I actually think it'd be a really good-looking car, except for the windshield is just bolt upright. And it's just round, unlike the rest of the car. It looks weird. But it was certainly aerodynamic. Like, it had that going for it, for sure. Because you look at the Saab, you look at the 900, and you think it looks like a brick. But when the 900 first came out, it was the most aerodynamic car on sale. It had a drag coefficient of 0.36, which these days that's like mediocre, but you know, for the late 70s, this thing is pretty good. 0.36, that's the same as a Bugatti Chiron. And so this weird little Swedish company made all these great technological advancements for the structure of the car and aerodynamics, and people noticed. Exactly the kind of people you'd expect to notice, really. Saabs were bought by wealthy people, but a very specific type of wealthy people, and not the sort you'd want as a luxury car builder. And that was really the problem that Saab always had. The cars were engineered to an incredibly high standard, and as a result, the cars cost a lot of money. And so they competed with luxury cars. And this is a problem because Saabs at their core weren't luxury cars. I'll explain. Saab makes luxury cars like Rolex makes luxury watches, which is to say, Rolex doesn't make luxury watches. Not really. And I'm not saying Rolexes are bad. They're quite the opposite, but they're not luxury watches. They're tool watches, or at least they're supposed to be. I mean, when I think of luxury watches, I think of stuff like AP or Patek or, I don't know, Piaget, stuff like that. Like very expensive watches created over the course of a million hours, and they have movements carved out of a single block of steel, and the cases are hewn from a chunk of titanium, which was once a part of the space shuttle, and the hands are carved out of the bones of the men who died crafting this watch, and the watch has a leather strap made from the skin of the dead dogs of former presidents, and there are only three authorized dealers in the Western Hemisphere, two of which are in Beverly Hills, and when you buy one, it comes with a servant. That's a luxury watch. In the car world, that's like a Rolls Royce. A Rolex is not that. Rolexes have always been expensive because they just work. And at first, that was kind of a novel thing. I mean, before Rolex came around, nobody had ever really heard of a watch that worked, let alone one that works when you climb Everest or go to the bottom of the ocean or any number of things like that. Rolexes were extremely well-made, durable, reliable tools. And in the car world, for the longest time, that was Mercedes. But for the sake of this discussion, Saab, it was Saab, at least in the realm of moderate, you know, modest luxury cars. Because that was always the segment that Saab competed in. You know, Saab wasn't trying to beat the S-Class, but Saab definitely competed among, you know, like the E-Class, which I guess the E-Class didn't exist at the time, but the, whatever, the 124 or whatever, you know, or the 123, that's that sort of stuff. Mid-tier BMWs, certainly basically anything Audi sold, stuff like that. Not necessarily cars for the top 1%, but cars that are bought by people who make an above-average amount of money. And among those people, Saab was always the favorite among the well-educated. Because before Subaru, every college professor, every architect, every structural engineer, every computer programmer, every graphic designer, every financial advisor, every foot doctor, the most boring people in any of those demographics drove Saabs. And so, in theory, you couldn't hope for a better, more reliable customer, except perhaps for just interesting people. But interesting people were buying Mercedes, and so that's why it was an odd choice when GM bought Saab, because they wanted a European luxury brand. Because, you see, in the late 80s, General Motors was really dying to buy a proper European luxury brand. They tried to buy Jaguar, and Jaguar is cool and sexy, and they have this kind of subtle, gentlemanly image, but Ford bought Jag out from under them. So what did GM do? They bought a controlling stake in Saab, the least cool luxury car maker who never actually made money. You know, in the realm of luxury automobiles, in that price bracket, Saabs weren't all that luxurious. They weren't beautiful. They just kind of looked weird. They were quick, but they weren't fast. And they were all just front-wheel drive family cars. Not really driver's cars, like BMW. But GM wanted a luxury brand, but they picked a weird one with very little brand recognition. And so however good the cars were, Saab never really had much of a brand. Same as Volvo. They're always just kind of one of... They're kind of the weird outlier that people only think of occasionally when they see one, but never really otherwise. And so, sure, you know, the cars are held in high regard, but as a luxury brand that GM wanted to use to boost their image in Europe, it wasn't really a super obvious pick. But truthfully, at that time, Saab probably needed GM more than GM needed Saab. Because Saab's engineering team, through the entire company's history, they always needed more money than they had. And that's not to say that anything was bad about it, or, you know, the engineering is bad. They always way over-engineered everything to the point of never making a profit. That was the problem. And so Saab looks at GM and thinks, hey, you know, they got all these engines and all sorts of stuff we can use to build cars. And GM would have loved if Saab did that, because it would have kept the costs down. But Saab pretty much just refused to take advantage of any of GM's resources. Saab's standards were too high. They wanted to revolutionize the way cars were built. That was Saab. Saab was always on the cutting edge when it came to new safety advancements and whatnot. Also, just weird ideas. Because you know how everybody talks about how stuff that premieres on the Mercedes S-Class eventually trickles down to every normal car over the course of 10 years? That was partly true of Saab also. You know, Saab came out with little stuff like, you know, those headlight wipers you saw on some European stuff through the 80s and 90s? Saab invented those. And Saab also invented ventilated seats, which that's kind of a big deal. I mean, basically every luxury car now has ventilated seats, but Saab introduced them on the 9.5 in 1998, 2 years before Mercedes could offer it on the S-Class. And that makes sense for Saab, because Saab didn't invent heated seats, but Saab was the first company to offer heated seats as a standard feature back in the day. You know, heated seats and Saab were kind of synonymous. And other stuff. Saab was the first company to use brake pads that didn't use asbestos. And that was in, like, the 80s. Like, this happened way later than you'd think it would, but technically, Saab did it, asbestos-free brake pads. But probably the single biggest contribution that Saab ever made to the automobile was turbochargers. Because, I mean, Saab didn't invent the turbocharger. They weren't the first to put it on a car. You know, Porsche was doing that in 75, but Saab was the first to put it on a normal car. You know, the regular Saab 9.9 used the standard Triumph Dolomite engine, and it was fine, but it was a little slow. And so Saab wanted more power, but they weren't that big a fan of big, thirsty V8s. You know, Saab had this image at that time, and certainly their customers appreciated this image of them making clean, quiet, fuel-efficient cars. Again, think of the people buying these. Or at least that was what Saab wanted. I mean, keep in mind, technically, up until 1980, they were still selling a car with a two-stroke engine, but whatever. What Saab wanted was the efficiency and lightness and quietness and general ease of use of a four-cylinder, but they wanted more power. And at the time, Saab was partnered with Scania, and they make big trucks, big turbo diesel trucks. And so Saab got the idea to install a turbocharger on their little four-cylinder, and the 99, little four-cylinder 99. And so the 99 Turbo was born in 78, and it was quick. It wasn't earth-shattering by today's standards, but I mean, for the time, it was a serious car. You know, 0 to 60 in about 8.5 seconds. But keep in mind, the same year that car came out, well, the Ferrari 308 did it in 7.5 seconds. Cars were really slow back then, but the headline is just that this thing is a little four-cylinder family car that can keep up with real sports cars. And so through the 80s and 90s, you saw mainstream automakers adopt turbocharging on their normal cars, and certainly nowadays just about every car sold is a turbocharged four-cylinder, and it all really started with Saab. So Saab was definitely an innovator. Part of that innovation was also some weird stuff. I'll get to that after the break. You're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio.
Sunbaked, sitting on the side of the road. 200 miles and we make it to the hideaway show. Storm clouds rising in the east and I just don't know. 'Cause the distance is long and the pass is high. And the clock keeps running. I don't know if we can make it on time. Tonight. Just seem to go along.
up north trying to make a scene in a new town. All day hanging on the corner just laying it down. Had the main man working the crowd to get the name around. Said I'll see you at the show and you can bring a friend or two. Can't afford to miss it, everybody's gonna.
So let's talk about some more Saab weirdness. So famously, Saab always mounted the ignition switch in the center stack. Center stack, more like down by the cup holders, you know. And their reasoning was it was safer because your knee couldn't just slam into the key if you got into a crash. In some of the early cars that had manuals, you had to put the car into reverse in order to remove the key. There's a physical latch. And so if you park the car, you can't forget to leave it in gear because otherwise you can't take the key out. And when the key is out, the shifter is locked in reverse. And they eventually stopped doing that, but they didn't really stop having that idea because on later manual Saabs, okay, you know how in every car, if you leave the key in the ignition and you open the door, the car beeps at you, you know, until you close the door or remove the key? Well, 2000s manual Saabs, the car would just beep at you no matter what, and whether the key was in it or not, unless the car was in reverse. And another weird thing, at one point, Saab got it in their heads that steering wheels are simply too unsafe. You know, it's too big, and you could get impaled by the column, or your head hits the wheel in the event of a crash. And so Saab developed a prototype. It was called the Prometheus, and the idea was you could steer the car with a joystick. It was mounted in the center controls, and you'd steer it with one hand, and it was also completely steer-by-wire, so it was kind of ahead of its time. It's like a Cybertruck now. It didn't really work, and the joystick was 180 degrees lock to lock, and so it was super twitchy. I mean, as you can imagine, steering the car was like trying to play Labyrinth, you know, that game with the board and the marble. That was like what it was like to steer the car, and thankfully it never made it into full production. But what it did make it into full production was Saab's Sensonic gearbox, because at one point Saab decided that manual transmissions were simply too difficult to use, but also automatics were too boring. So in the early 90s, they started offering their Sensonic transmission, which it had a regular shift, manual shift lever. You know, you'd move it around in a H-gate pattern, like a regular manual, except you didn't use a clutch pedal. The car would operate the clutch for you. And when I say operate, I mean, like, it had two settings. There was engaged and disengaged. It tried to avoid slipping the clutch, so you couldn't just, like, feather the gas or anything to keep the thing from, you know, creeping. Like, it would just creep wherever it wanted to unless you pressed down hard enough on the car to get the car moving. It was garbage. It never really worked. But an actually cool feature from Saab, you know how in most cars you're driving along at night, you know, and this is probably a modern thing. It's probably Saab inspired this, and I just don't realize it. But in every car, usually, you can control how bright or dim the interior lights are. And so, you know, if you want to stop from getting glare, seeing reflections, or, you know, if you want to see better, you can turn all the interior lights down. That's pretty standard. Well, Saab did this idea years ago, and they called it the night panel. And they tried to pitch it as being like an aviation thing, like a tie-in with the fighter jets. But what it does is it completely shuts off all the other gauges and dims all the interior lights except for the speedometer. And even that's only illuminated up to 90 miles an hour. And it's, you know, that's a neat feature. But anyway, moving on, because I kind of skipped ahead. I want to talk about Saab's first real luxury car, the 9000. The Saab 9000, it was co-developed with Fiat, more specifically the Lancia division. And the theory was they were both small fledgling automakers who needed a good luxury car. And Saab had worked with Lancia before. I mean, worked is a strong word. Because at one point, Lancia just let Saab rebadge a Lancia Delta as the Saab Lancia 600. But that was in the past. And Saab needed a decent luxury car. And so Saab and Lancia worked together on the 9000/Thema. And famously, during crash tests, the car pretty much just fell to pieces. So by Lancia standards, it was, you know, it was pretty solid. That was about what you expect. So they greenlit that. But Saab wasn't going to have any of that. And so they spent almost as much money as it would have cost to develop a whole new car, just bringing the car up to their standards. Although, despite that, fun fact, the early 9000 actually failed U.S. crash tests. Like, even after Saab went over it, they had to go back to the drawing board. But by the time the 9000 was in production, it was an excellent car. It was better than whatever other cars were built on it on the same platform. But it owed them a lot of money. And this is Saab, and they never really figured out how to make any money. In that car, it was sold as the Saab 9000, the Lancia Thema, the Alfa Romeo 164, and the Fiat Croma. So if you remember that Top Gear challenge where they had to make limos, and James May basically spliced a Saab 9000 and Alfa Romeo 164 together, that was why that worked so well. Like, the basic shape at that part of the car matched perfectly, but really the Saab version was practically a different car, different crash structures, completely different engines, obviously different bodies, and all the usual Saab weirdness. I say weirdness. Apparently, the guy who designed the interior of the 9000 said that he styled the seats after the seats in the spaceship in those old Muppets sketches, the Pigs in Space sketches. And that's weird enough. What's even weirder is that they bear absolutely no resemblance. It's weird enough that he styled it after them. What's worse is they don't look anything like them. But whatever. But another weird thing about the 9000 interior is when you shut the car off and you turn it back on again, the car sets the temperature the way it thinks it should be set, like the climate control. It sets the temperature how it thinks it should be. It doesn't care what you left it at. The car just resets how it sees fit. And in theory, that's not a bad idea. I mean, a couple times a year. You know, like in the spring or the fall, you know, you get in the car in the morning and you turn on the heat because it's cold out, but then you're at work or school or whatever all day, the sun comes out and it gets hot. So you have to turn the climate control down to the opposite extreme to go home. So I can see that being a useful feature, I guess. I think it would just annoy me because in most cases, I know best when it comes to car HVAC. I hate automatic climate control, for example. Let me control it. Don't mess with anything. Like, if I left it on heat and I need it cold, I'll deal with the consequences of my actions. It's not something you have to decide for me. But another weird thing about Saab was that for years, their naming convention didn't really make any sense to anybody because, okay, some people think that when Saab changed from the 900 to the 9.3 and the 9000 became the 9.5, they were trying to call back to their early cars, the Saab 93 and the 95. Actually, it was just a complete coincidence. Because first of all, Saab models in general are confusing as hell because even when they come out with a new car to replace a previous one, they often just keep making the old one alongside the new one. And that was usually pretty easy to do because the cars were usually fundamentally the same anyway. So, like, for example, Saab had the 9.6. It came out in 1960. And they more or less replaced it with the 99 in 1968. But they kept making the 9.6 until 1980. And speaking of the 99, ostensibly they replaced it with the 900 in 1979. But it was more or less just a slightly modified 99. But whatever. Okay, new car. But they kept making the 99 for another 5 years until 84. And then the 99 was replaced with the 90. So that's a smaller number. You think, okay, well, is it like, you know, is it supposed to be the worst car in this lineup? No, it's the newer car. And in some ways, it's better. It's largely the same as the other car you sell, too. And that's not to say the 90 and the 900 were the same car. They were slightly different. The 900 was slightly longer. But they were two barely different cars. And then in 1985, they came out with 9000. And ultimately, the 90 just kind of went away, and it was sort of absorbed into the newer, nicer 900. And the 9000 eventually went away. So you kind of see what's happened. Saab, for a while, you know, you think about that. Well, it had this somewhat nice, easy-to-understand system of car naming, really. You know, 90 is the cheap one, 900 for the mid-range, 9000 for the nice one. But Saab, up to that point, tended to not reuse names, except, I guess, for the Sonnet and then GM took over the 900, and that got a redesign. But they always started with a 9. And so, you know, the 90 kind of transitions really into the 900. What are you going to call the 9000? Well, if you follow the 900 trend, you just call it the 9000. But no, the next one in the series, logically, is the 90,000, which sounds stupid. Nobody's calling a car the Saab 90,000. So one running theory as to why it was called the 9.5 is because it's a 9, but I guess it's a five-figure number. You know, it's 9, and then it's a five-figure number. And so they say that's why they always format it like 9 and then a little tiny 5 or 9-5. That's that theory. I've heard that one thrown around for sure. I've also heard this other one that makes no sense to me whatsoever. Some people say that like 9 to the power of 5 is some weird number that happens to contain the number 9 twice and is also a smaller number than that of the designation of the original prototype Saab car. And that makes no sense to me whatsoever, but it's Saab, so I mean, who knows? That one just kind of sounds like the kind of explanation you give to the Missouri Department of Revenue to explain why you want a slightly dirty personalized license plate. Like, you're just making stuff up to make it fit, you know? To me, it makes more sense. They just called it the 9.5 and the 9.3 just to kind of show where a car sits in the lineup. Like, the 9.5 roughly competes with the BMW 5 Series. 9.3 roughly competes with the 3 Series. That makes the most sense. Swedish car companies have always been horrible with names. Because for years, Volvo was even worse than that. I've been meaning to rant about this for a while. I won't spend long on it because it has nothing to do with Saab. But like, if you don't know, the old Volvo naming convention was as follows. Okay, it was three digits. The first was the generation or series of the passenger cars. Although they started doing that well into their time making regular passenger cars. But okay, so it starts with one. At the 100 series, beginning in 1966, and then the 200 series, so like the 240 in 1974. Makes enough sense. You know? Like, the 200 series came after the 100 series. Fine. The second digit is the number of cylinders. So, like, a 240 is the second generation Volvo, and it has a four-cylinder engine. You know, that makes sense. And originally, the third digit meant the number of doors. So, originally, the 240 was offered as the 242, which is the coupe, the 244 for the sedan, 245 for the wagon. Makes perfect sense. And it even still made sense when they came out with the third-gen car, the 300 series, in 1976. And then they kind of stopped counting the number of doors, so the 242, 44, 45 just became the 240, and that's how most people know it now. And then inexplicably, they jumped from the 300 series to the 700 series for 1983. And I should clarify, most of these cars coexisted. It wasn't like the 300 replaced the 200. They were just different models. And it wasn't like one was inherently nicer or better than the other. It was just that the 300 was newer than the 200. You just had to know that. There was no hierarchy. It was just that one was newer than the other. And then for 1986, Volvo really threw a wrench in the work because they released the 480. And that proved, okay, well, the 400 series was definitely available. Why'd you skip to 700? But whatever. And the engine thing. Well, 480. Does it have a V8? No, it's a four-cylinder. It's a front-wheel drive hatchback. And then a couple of years later, they released the 440 and the 460, and both of those were four-cylinders. There was no six either. And by that point, the middle number basically just indicated the trim level. So my point is, Volvo's naming convention fell off quick. And also, even if this naming convention was followed perfectly to a T, nobody would have understood it. Because the bigger the number, it's not the nicer the car, like with every other brand. It's just the bigger the number, the newer the car. And even that isn't strictly true. Again, 700 came before the 400. So by the late 90s, Volvo eventually realized that all this was stupid. They started just naming their cars normally, like C for coupe, S for sedan, so on. And the numbers get bigger with the bigger size of the car, you know. That's Swedish naming conventions for you. Saab fell victim too. But speaking of names, back to Saab, okay? They were really the first automaker to install turbochargers on regular family cars, you know, as I talked about earlier. And early on, the turbo versions were always just called the turbo, you know, the 99 turbo or the 900 turbo and so on. And that was brilliant. And Saab was really the company that started the whole turbo craze that still exists today. So they had a right to that better than anybody. They can call whatever they want the turbo. But eventually taste shifted and people thought that simply calling stuff turbo was a little too 1980s. And so, for example, Volvo stopped calling it the 850 turbo. They started calling it the 850 T5. And in general, you know, if you wanted a high-performance version of a car, and even still today, they just called it the S or the R or whatever. But when Saab replaced the 900 with the 9.3, they didn't call the turbo version the 9.3 turbo. They just called it the 9.3. You just had to know if it was a turbo. And then they came out with an even faster one. And this one was called the Viggen. And listen, I understand that Viggen might sound cool if you're Swedish, but when I think of Swedish, I don't think any Swedish words sound cool or exciting or aggressive in any way. I'm sorry. Swedish people have, like, fish and wooden boats and like, stuff like that. I don't think of them as having aggressive, and certainly not Viggen. Viggen was supposed to tie in with Saab's fighter jet, the 37 Viggen, and they said that the name meant Thunderbolt. And I've heard some argument from the Swedes about whether it actually does or doesn't mean Thunderbolt. Although, Saab has also said that Viggen literally translates to a type of tufted duck. Which, I mean, for an airplane, fine. This is a car. So, I mean, there's your BMW M3 Slayer, the Saab tufted duck. And eventually they just replaced Viggen with Arrow, which sounded better. Although, to be fair, for years, you know, I just thought Arrow meant the wagon version. So, I mean, to me, Arrow doesn't exactly scream high performance either, but at least it's better than Viggen. Anything's better than Viggen. And ultimately, as time went on, GM did what GM always does. They just did some crappy rebadges. The 900 was redesigned in 1994, and it wasn't really a completely original Saab. It was based on the Opel Vectra, loosely, but, I mean, even GM would have preferred it to just be a standard Vectra, just with a different body, but it only shared a third of the parts. And it was the same story with the 9.5 and then the new 9.3. And the problem was Saab just refused to spend anything less than an absolute fortune turning GM cars into Saabs. But even still, at their core, you know, Saab's bread and butter cars were just badge-engineered Opels. They weren't proper Saabs of old. And so in 2000, GM bought the rest of Saab. And prior to that, they only had like a 50% stake. They bought the rest of it. And now they had complete control. And Saab was just a GM subsidiary. And so, as I talked about this a few weeks ago. In the early 2000s, big luxury SUVs are really taken off, and GM decided that Saab needed one to compete. And so, rather than Saab creating their own SUV from the ground up, they were forced to just use the good old GMT 360 platform, basically the Chevy Trailblazer. And so the 97X was born, the Saab 97X. And it was nicer than a Trailblazer, which isn't super hard to be, really. And there was even a 97X Aero, which was basically just a nicer, more luxurious, uglier Chevy Trailblazer SS. And also, this was at a time when GM owned a pretty decent chunk of Subaru. And so Saab got its own version of the Subaru Impreza for two model years, 05 and 06. It was a Subaru WRX wagon, but it had a slightly nicer interior and a slightly different body, and it was called the Saab 92X Aero. And it was strange. But those cars didn't make up most of Saab's sales. I mean, really, they mostly sold the old 9.3 and 9.5. The problem those cars had was that ultimately they were very good, but they were still just 90s GM crap underneath, and so they weren't real proper luxury cars. But also, Saab wasn't really willing to compromise on engineering costs. Everything had to be done to their standards, and so the cars were expensive. And so the cars were simultaneously not as good as they could have been while being more expensive than they should have been. And that describes Saab for the last 10 years or so of its existence. But all those cars were eventually canceled, and you could pretty much tell where Saab was headed by this point. Even until the end, Saab was working on new cars. They had an updated 9.5 almost ready, and they were talking about building a Saab version of the Subaru Tribeca. And that sounds like a winner. That's a good idea. And there was going to be a Saab version of the Cadillac SRX. It was called the 9.4X. But ultimately, though, Saab just kept losing money. And when GM got bailed out in 2009, they started to try and figure out how to dump Saab. And so in 2010, GM sold Saab to Spyker. You know, Spyker made the C8, that sports car from the early 2000s. And Saab threw the new 9.5 on sale to try and get some money out of it. And as part of the deal, GM was going to produce the 94X, but that didn't really work out. They only managed to build like 800 of those before they ran out of money, and Saab had to be sold again. And Saab was sold to a Chinese EV company called National Electric Vehicle Sweden, or NEVS, and they also didn't do much with it. But they did put the 9.3 back on sale briefly in 2014, although they used the Saab name. It was the Saab. It was a Saab 9.3, but they couldn't use the logo because, again, Saab, the defense contractor, still exists, and they didn't want their logo to be used on these cars. And so, and another problem was these new, quote-unquote, new 9.3s were the same as the old 9.3s, and they didn't meet Euro NCAP safety regulations anymore. And so, legally, they were only they were limited to selling 1,000 of these cars in Europe in a given year. And they also only offered them in black and silver. And eventually, NEVS redesigned the 9.3 to be an EV, and they sold it in China for a little while. So when people say the last Saab was the last Saab was the 9.5 or the 9.4X, that's not strictly true. Technically, the last car to ever wear a Saab badge was the good old 9.3. But that's pretty much it. Saab is gone. Saab was an interesting experiment, but it didn't succeed. But that's pretty much all I got this week. I'm going to go ahead and run through the damn radio schedule really quick. So, 9 to 10:30, coming up here in about 2 hours. This is 5 days a week, International Flavor with Sam Trapp. Also 5 days a week, 2 to 4, Monday through Friday. Really Big Shoe with JR. And tomorrow night, 5:30 to 7:30, Show Me History Show. Also, International Flavor, 5 days a week. It's Saturday through Thursday, not Monday through Friday. And then Wednesday starts at 9, Damn Swag, Jimmy Tebow. 11 to 1, Gabby Hayes Show. Really Big Shoe. 6 to 8, the Ike Skelton Radio Show, International Flavor. And Thursday, it's just Really Big Shoe, International Flavor. Friday, Nadine at 9 with Nadine at 9. And it's a legislative update with Miss M. And 6 to 8, Friday night, Eye of the Beholder with Pauly. And then Sunday, International Flavor, 9 to 10:30. Monday, it depends on the Monday, I guess, but sometimes it's 9, sometimes it's 11. Shield Maidens of Missouri, Really Big Shoe. And then we're back to this show. So I should be back next week unless I, you know, have something come up or whatever. But anyway, this has been Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio. Thank you for listening.